8 below for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Wind from the west at 9. Wind chill now 20 below. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Monday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. A look at Google on today's program. And a quick reminder that tomorrow on the program, we look forward to welcoming back Dr. Art Sear to offer his analysis of current events. On today's morning show, we're going to be taken behind the scenes and into the earliest days of Google, one of the world's most powerful and influential companies. My guest is Douglas Edwards, who was one of the earliest employees at Google and one of the oldest at the time. He's written a very intriguing memoir about his experiences there, which is called I'm Feeling Lucky, The Confessions of Google Employee Number 59. The book is published by Mariner Books. It's important that we are careful to say exactly what this book is. This is not an exhaustive, complete history of everything that happened at Google in the time that you were there. If it's not that, then what do you want this book to be?
Well, you know, there are a lot of really excellent books out about Google now. Stephen Levy and Ken Auletta have both written really wonderful histories in part of Google. And my book is different because I really wanted to try to capture what it felt like to be part of Google in its early days when it was only 50 or 60 employees and as it grew to thousands of employees. So mine is a more personal story, a more inside look, if you will, because unless you were part of what was happening at that time, you really can't talk about it with the same kind of voice. So it's a more personal take on Google's history and what it was like, especially for someone like myself who was 41 at the time I started working at Google, which put me definitely in the older group of employees. And it was quite an adjustment from working at a very traditional company.
Right. It seems to me that, I mean, obviously anybody who's technologically savvy and interested in the internet and interested in knowing more about Google is going to really love your book. But it's even possible, I think, for someone with rather scant interest in such things to also find your book really compelling, because it is, in some respects, the story of a fish out of water, or whatever metaphor you want to use to describe someone not exactly in their zone of comfort. I mean, doing something they are excited to do and yet, in some respects at least, out of step with almost everybody around them, and in a sense very much out of step or swimming against the stream or working against the grain of kind of the cultural climate of the place. I find that in and of itself so interesting, even apart from the specific exciting story of Google.
Well, I think a lot of people, have had experiences where they found themselves in a completely at sea and in a new environment, and that was me at Google. I mean, I came in because I'd been working in marketing 20, 25 years already and had a lot of experience and some success, and I thought, I'll bring all that to this new company, and I'm sure I'll be like a senior mentor, and people will turn to me and say, well, how do you do this kind of thing? And then instead, I found that the experience I thought was so valuable coming into this young company was not really valued all that much by the people who were there. And I had to spend a lot of time really unlearning the things that I had learned earlier in my career, because not only did they not see me as a mentor, sometimes I felt like, you know, my view was seen as outdated or not really the kind of thing that Google wanted to do, because they wanted to do everything in a new and innovative way. So it was really quite a challenge to readjust my own thinking, and I talk about that quite a bit in the book, you know, how hard it is to retool yourself for a completely new environment.
Absolutely. At one line in the introduction, I think, says it so well. You say that this book is about how you found yourself in an environment where old rules did not apply and where relying on what I knew to be true almost got me fired.
Yeah.
I mean, it has to be exciting and invigorating and terrifying all at the same time to find yourself working at such a place. I mean, it's like an astronaut finding themselves on an alien world with completely different laws of physics, for instance.
Well, it was like that. And to be honest, I mean, there were times I wasn't sure I was going to make it, but there were also times when I felt, wow, this is, you know, the best job I've ever had, the most challenging environment I've ever been in. I had to really push myself to try to keep up with the other people who were there. And that attitude was very pervasive at Google. I mean, I think everyone felt like they looked around and they saw the people who were accomplishing these amazing things and felt like they had to up their own game or be left behind. So, that can be quite exhilarating when you see that you're being as productive as you've ever been before, but also nerve-wracking if you feel like, well, even that might not be good enough.
By the way, I don't want the interview to finish without me giving you a chance to explain this intriguing title. I'm Feeling Lucky, The Confessions of Google Employee Number 59. There's a couple of different things to probably explain, at least to some of our listeners who might not quite understand all that your title implies.
Well, I'm Feeling Lucky comes from the button that's on the homepage of the Google search engine. If you go to google.com, one of the buttons says, I'm feeling lucky next to the search button. And if you enter a term into Google and you push that button, or click on that link, it will take you immediately to the first result that Google finds. So you don't see the usual result page with 10 results listed. You go straight to the top of the list, to the web page that's there. And the reason that button is on Google's homepage is because when Google's technology was first developed and first launched, Sergey Brin, one of the co-founders, felt that it was so good, so much better than the competition, that he wanted people to click that link and just, you know, trust that Google would find them the right answer. So it was a bit of bravado on his part, but he and Larry Page, the other co-founder, were so confident in Google's technological superiority that they wanted to put a little attitude on the homepage about it. And I always like that, because there's really no reason for it to be there other than to express attitude or a little, you know, what I would call branding, you know, part of the personality of the website. So it seemed like an appropriate title for the book. The Employee 59 part is just, in Silicon Valley, when you work for a startup or work for any technology company, it's pretty common knowledge where you started in the company, what your sequentially assigned employee rank is. And so it just tells everybody else that, oh, okay, here's the point at which you joined the company. So obviously the lower the number, the earlier you joined. And, you know, I was employee 59, meaning that I joined the same week as a couple of other people, including the massage therapist, who was employee number 58, I think.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Douglas Edwards, and we're talking about his book, I'm Feeling Lucky, The Confessions of Google Employee Number 59. Douglas Edwards served as Director of Consumer Marketing and Brand Management from 1999 to 2005. Especially for the sake of our listeners, there are probably a few who do not have a rich understanding of how far Google has come. I mean, I think most of our listeners, maybe even all, know exactly what Google is famous for now. But could you trace, for the sake of listeners less familiar with Google, what Google was when you joined up with them in 1999? What kind of a company was it? What were they all about versus all that they do now? Just give us some sense of how much has changed in those years.
Well, Google started in a dorm room. It was actually Larry and Sergey, Larry Page and Sergey Brin, and were at Stanford graduate students. And they developed this ranking algorithm, a way of determining which pages were most important when you searched a database. And so they quickly realized that this technology was more powerful than the search technology that was being used by Yahoo and Excite and AltaVista and all the other search engines at the time. And so they initially tried to sell it to Yahoo, and Yahoo said, no, you know, why don't you go start a company, and if we like it, we'll license it. We'll rent it from you. And so they did. They went off and they started a company, and the time that I joined, they'd been around for about a year as a company and were starting to add people to the staff who were not engineers. The engineers were all working really on improving the back end of the search engine. The ranking algorithm worked really well, but it was not very strong in terms of its ability to serve results quickly and to a very large audience. So there were hundreds of thousands of users, but they needed to prepare to serve millions of users, and it was a really big technological challenge. So most of the people at the company were focused on that. All we had was a search engine. We didn't have mail. We didn't have calendar. We didn't have Google Maps, any of those things. That all came later. So initially, it was all just about the search engine.
Hmm. And at that point, you were one of a number of search engines, correct? I mean, it was a relatively crowded field.
It was a very crowded field, and people, in fact, wondered, when I told them I was leaving the Mercury News, which was a very stable company, or so I thought, to go join a search engine, people were like, well, search engines, who needs another search engine? We already have, dozens of them. But the problem was that none of them worked terribly well. And so when I found one that actually worked pretty well, it was clear that there might be something to the company that would be worth watching.
Right. You know, it's funny. This portion of the interview, I was in my mind picturing, maybe a 65-year-old grandmother listening to the program who's a little less seasoned, let's say, in surfing the Internet and so on, although by no means do I mean to generalize. I mean, I think there are plenty of 65- and 75-year-olds and even 85-year-olds who know what the Internet is and know what Google is. I'm realizing now that this question in some respects is almost more appropriate for the sake of, for instance, someone who's college age right now. I mean, the students I have where I teach college who do not remember, as I do and other people a little older, the days when you would turn on a computer and you'd be confronted by 20 or 30 different search engine options, and you could click on whichever one. And at least for me, I had little or no notion of what's the difference between Excite or AltaVista or whatever. And part of what you're describing is a world where there really wasn't much difference between any of those, but there was a difference with Google.
Right. Most of the search engines at that time relied on very simple principles. So if you entered a search for baseball, you were trying to find, or specifically, let's say, the Milwaukee Brewers, and you entered that search, they would go out onto the Internet, they would look for every page that contained the words Milwaukee Brewers, and they would then return those pages. And if the words Milwaukee Brewers occurred more than once on the page, they would deem it to be twice as valuable or three times as valuable as a page where it only occurred one time. And so that was, a real problem for the search engines, because the pages where those words occurred the most frequently were not necessarily the most authoritative pages on that topic. And so Google went out and said, well, we don't want to just count the number of times a phrase occurs. We want to look at other pages that link to that page and see if they're authoritative. So if they were linking to that page from, you know, a baseball authority or another team, then you would suspect that they were actually more valuable than a page that just had the words repeated several times. And so that actually turned out to be a very useful way of ranking web pages, by looking at who linked to them instead of just what occurred on the page itself.
Mm. And this was a gigantic breakthrough, although one has the sense that most of the world had no idea what this breakthrough was all about.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you really had to be kind of interested in the technology itself of search and information retrieval to get this initially. But those who understood it, including the venture capitalists who invested in Google in the early days, really got it. And some of the earliest investors were professors at Stanford who had worked with Larry and Sergey and, you know, really did understand the value of a ranking algorithm that was more sophisticated than just looking for search terms.
Hmm. One thing that I think could possibly mislead people as they read your book, or I think I jumped to a really erroneous conclusion as I first began reading it, is as you describe yourself in the early days of Google as a little bit of a fish out of water, I mean, much older than most of the people there, you also describe how you were not working at Google with anything approaching the sort of scientific or technological background of many of the people who worked there, which was another way in which you were out of step with maybe the cutting edge of certain people who worked there. But by no means were you entirely ignorant. I mean, you weren't, you know, Amish or something. I mean, you weren't hopelessly backward when it came to such matters. But when you are working at a place like Google that employs these incredibly brilliant, talented engineers, then, you know, just about any of us, even those of us who use a computer a lot, would still, you know, sort of feel like we're kind of back in the horse and buggy era. Can you just talk about that a moment?
Well, sure. I was an English major coming into a company that was primarily engineers. And, you know, I was computer literate. Clearly, I had been living in Silicon Valley. I was somewhat up to speed on what was going on in computers. But you're right when you say, I mean, the people I was working with were some of the sharpest minds in computer science at the time. And, you know, just being computer literate meant that I could sometimes understand what they were talking about, but it didn't mean that I was qualified to do any of the technical work. And it was a company that was built on engineering as the primary force. And so there was somewhat of a lack of understanding or even tolerance for marketing as a profession, because they felt that the product should really be the focus and the service should really be the determinant in whether or not people used it. So if you had to rely on marketing to get people to use your engineering-based product, then you had failed as engineers, because it should be so good that people would immediately want to use it just because it was the best technology available. And so that was a bit of a struggle, too, coming in from companies where marketing was at least seen as a necessary thing that you did to promote your market share, to gain market share. And Google just did not view marketing that way. They really wanted to focus on the engineering. And at one point, Larry Page said to me, you know, if we have to win with marketing, then we don't deserve to win at all. We should just, you know, fold up and go home, because it will mean that we have failed as a technology company to deliver the best technology.
Hmm. One of the things that is a little curious to me that I find especially fascinating is how you describe Google as a workplace in those early days. That on the one hand, it was in many respects wildly unconventional, maybe not by Silicon Valley standards, but compared to most workplaces across the country, it was really something quite out of the ordinary and youthful and vibrant and almost juvenile in many respects. And yet, on the other hand, you write about how Google's highest priority back then was efficiency and frugality. And I mean, very high sounding concepts. So I wonder if you could just kind of reconcile those two aspects of Google, which are not exactly contradictory, and yet, on the other hand, not at all the same thing.
Well, you know, people hear that Google offers all of their employees free meals, and one of the first hires, the same week that I started, was a chef who had previously worked with the Grateful Dead cooking for them. And so you hear things like that in massage therapists, and you think, wow, they're really frivolous or they're really extravagant in the way they treat employees. But the founders had done this cost-benefit analysis, and they looked at what it would cost to have employees leave the building every day. We were in an industrial park. It was not a place where there were any nearby restaurants. So you'd have to leave the building every day, go out to lunch, probably take an hour, you know, and as soon as you leave the building, you're focused on things other than work, as opposed to having healthy meals served in the building where people could go down to lunch, eat for 20 minutes while they sat with their coworkers and talked about work, and then went back to work immediately. And we had, you know, we could take an hour for lunch, but everybody was too busy to take an hour for lunch. So people would go down, grab a quick bite, talk about work, go back to work. And so if you think about the cost of an hour of an engineer's time or an executive's time, it was a very cost-effective to keep people in the building. And that was really behind all of the other great services they offered as well. I mean, the massages helped people relax. It helped people, you know, stay sharp on the job. And it was better to have people stay in the building from their viewpoint than to go off. So we had on-site dental, we had on-site doctors, we had on-site dry cleaning, you could get your car washed at work. You never really had to leave. And most of the employees rarely left before putting in a 12 or 14 or even a 16-hour day. So it was, you know, very cost-effective from their standpoint, to offer all of these great services.
As you discuss Google as a working environment in the early days, a conversation that you recount gives you the opportunity to share something that Larry said about frequent flyer miles being evil. And it's just a really intriguing way for us to understand kind of a different way of looking at something that the rest of us sort of accept and completely take for granted. Can you share this story with our listeners?
Yes. This goes back to what I was saying about the company focusing on winning through technology, through a superior product. And in Larry's view, you know, I asked him once, maybe we could do some kind of frequent searcher program where we reward people who come back to Google, you know, frequently to do their searches, and like a frequent flyer program on an airline. And he said, no, frequent flyer programs are if not evil, at least they're misguided, because what they do is they encourage people to pick an airline based on that kind of loyalty program, as opposed to picking an airline because it offers the cheapest flights or the most direct flights. And if you are persuaded by something other than getting there as quickly and cheaply as possible, then your evaluative process has been distorted somehow. You know, you've made a decision based on the wrong criteria. And as someone who really valued efficiency and not wasting time and, you know, not wasting money, that to him was just wrong. I mean, you why would you do that? Why would you allow yourself to be persuaded to do something that was really not in your ultimate best interest? And if these frequent flyer points or miles were distorting your evaluation of efficiency, then there must be something wrong with them.
Hmm. We're speaking with Douglas Edwards. We're talking about his book, I'm Feeling Lucky, The Confessions of Google Employee Number 59. The book talks about his years working at Google. You've touched on this, but I would love for you to explore this a little further, because I think there are probably parallel experiences in other workplaces and other environments. You talk about very early on understanding the very different way in which the two basic divisions of Google operated, especially when they had to tackle a problem. So those of you who were in marketing, you would tackle a problem or a question or a challenge one way, and the engineers had a completely different way of approaching a given problem or challenge. And once in a while, it was really one and the same challenge, but maybe with a couple of different facets, and you'd be attacking it from different ways, different directions, but in completely different ways and with very, in a sense, different priorities in mind. Can you describe that dichotomy?
Well, I came from a traditional company. I came from marketing, and our way of approaching these things typically was, we'd look at the problem, we'd evaluate it, we'd write up a plan, we'd talk about, all of the different considerations that needed to go into it, and then we'd take the plan to a senior executive or the next level up, and we would try to get sign-off on that, and then maybe revise it, and then, bring it back and to a committee or whatever. And so it was a much more, kind of studied way of approaching things. Engineers would look at a problem, and they'd say, this is broken, I can fix it, I'm going to fix it, it's done. And they didn't bother to really ask for a lot of permission. If it was something was wrong, if it was broken, then you just fix it, because not fixing it was to admit that imperfection was okay. And so if they knew that something would be better for the user if they changed it, they just went ahead and changed it without really trying to get buy-in. So the example I gave in the book was about one of the fonts that supposedly was more readable if you used a sans serif font. And so I wrote a proposal saying, we should change our font to this as part of our UI guidelines, and, was waiting to get approval on it. And I came in the morning and I found out that the engineers had already changed it overnight because they had read an article saying it was better to use this other font, unrelated to my proposal. They had already gone ahead and made the change. And so that was really instructive for me to see that, I needed to streamline my own thinking about, okay, if there's a problem, I just need to figure out how to get it fixed and just move ahead with it and not wait for, approval from the higher-ups.
Hmm. I guess that's one way in which that's one indication of something you say repeatedly, that Google lacked process, or at least not the standard process, sort of system of process that a lot of other companies had, or did not have a similar sort of hierarchy and clear chain of command. I mean, there were certain links in the chain, but I mean, it wasn't anything like maybe a standard company's operation.
Yeah, when I worked at the Mercury News, we used to have these weekly marketing committee meetings in the very imposing boardroom, and the publisher would preside, and there would be representatives from all the different groups, and we would go through, an agenda, and we would consider things, and it would take hours. And when I got to Google, it was just much more, you'd run into Larry or Sergey in line at the cafeteria, and you'd ask them a question, and boom, you were done. That was all it took. So it was a much more fluid kind of environment, and that got confusing at times because you didn't know what other questions had been answered in line at the cafeteria that might be contradictory to the one that you just had responded to. And so that could lead to a lot of confusion around things. But generally, people were viewed as independent operators, and everybody was supposed to just figure out what needed to be done in their space and then attack it. Hmm. So not a lot of process, no organizational charts, no job descriptions, no process in the sense of standing meetings that you would go to get resolution. And sometimes that made it hard to get problems resolved because you weren't really sure who could help you resolve it.
It was also an environment in which you especially and some of your colleagues would repeatedly feel marginalized. I mean, for instance, in the story that you just told us about this font getting changed, but it certainly happened in other instances in even more sort of potent fashion. You used the word marginalized more than once in this book, and probably in other companies where duties are delineated a little more clearly and where the hierarchy is followed very closely, that marginalization probably wouldn't happen as often as it did at Google.
Well, and some of that was, attributable to the way that they ran the company as a meritocracy, where anybody could come up with an idea, and that idea would be evaluated on its own merits, which is a great thing. I mean, it was wonderful that everybody could contribute to every problem, and the best ideas, or, you know, or what was determined to be the best idea would win. But it did mean that, you know, you didn't have any absolute authority as somebody in the marketing side over marketing issues just because you were the marketing person. And, you know, a lot of the ideas that came up were somewhat extraordinary. I mean, Sergey at one point decided that he wanted to take the marketing budget and spend it all inoculating refugees in the Chechen conflict in Russia, and that would be a better use of the marketing budget than doing the kind of things that we had been doing, you know, in buying ads or, you know, traditional PR kind of things, because he felt that we would get this wonderful press as a humanitarian company for helping these poor refugees in Chechnya. And we were able to persuade him that that was not really the correct way to go with the marketing budget. But he had a lot of ideas like that. He wanted to give away free condoms branded with Google's name to high school students. So, you know, when you have this kind of open-ended environment where every idea is considered, it does mean that it's sometimes hard to exert any authority over an area in which you are supposed to have responsibility.
Right. And as you describe this story, you make a really interesting point, and it underlines a very interesting irony. We all wrestled with Google's ambiguous structure. Who were the stakeholders? Who made the final call when we disagreed? Did Larry or Sergey need to approve everything we did? Apparently, the company's focus on efficiency did not extend to decision management.
Yeah.
I mean, and they probably, probably to them felt like the easiest and most efficient way to function. But maybe for the rest of you, and maybe for Google as a whole, it in fact maybe wasn't at all the most efficient way to advance good ideas.
And it was a small company at the time. So, I mean, it worked at that level. I mean, it worked when you had fewer than 100 employees, but as the company is now 24, 25,000 employees, you can't really run the company that way. There has to be more process. And in fact, that process did get layered on over time to some degree. I think it probably still has less than most major companies its size, and I think there's probably still some of that chaos, you know, for employees there. But, they couldn't continue to just make every decision off the cuff. And so they did set up some regular meetings, and they did layer in some evaluation tools for getting to decisions more quickly.
Right. But it's so interesting how even when some of that is implemented, how it is done in a very uncommon or unconventional fashion. For instance, you describe the setting up of OKRs, objectives and key results. And ultimately, when it came to meeting these sort of delineated goals, it wasn't done at all in the way that you would have expected. Explain to my listeners what we're talking about.
Well, this was a process that actually came from John Doerr, who's a well-known venture capitalist and one of the early investors in Google. And it's something that he had seen at other companies and tried to implement at other companies he'd invested in. And it basically set goals for each employee. And you would come up with a list of goals, and then you would have a list of the steps that were going to take you from where you were to attaining that goal. And it was interesting because I had expected, okay, well, if you set 10 goals, you're supposed to hit all 10 goals. And in fact, the way the company implemented OKRs, if you hit more than 70% of your goals, you had done something wrong. And what you had done wrong was you had not been ambitious enough. And so the idea was not that you would do everything on your list of OKRs. The idea was that you would prioritize and you would attain, about 70%, which would indicate that you had been ambitious in your goals, but you'd also gotten a lot done. So that was kind of mind-blowing for me because I always expected that if I set a list of goals, I would achieve them all. So that was just one of the ways in which OKRs were a different approach to goal setting within the company.
Hmm. I love how you describe at one point being feeling like you were handicapped by your degree in English. You write, a burden I alone struggled to bear. It wasn't that I didn't understand basic HTML tags, but my limited knowledge left me unilaterally disarmed. I had brought a cap gun to an Uzi drive-by. As my colleagues furiously revised code on the fly and sent iterations ricocheting, I resorted to paper and color markers to render my ideas. That patronizing chuckle you bestow on toddlers for stick figure portraits, it became the soundtrack of my presentations. Nevertheless, there was a place for you at Google and an important role for you to play as Google's word guy. Describe the most important things that you did as Google's so-called word guy.
I found this role for myself over time. I realized that I was never going to be the one who was fixing the code, and even on the graphic side, I was part of the user interface or UI committee, which is what I was describing in that passage you read, where all of my colleagues were, you know, specialists or had a lot more experience in designing web pages than I did. But I did find that there was a need for someone to manage the language that we used in communicating with our users, whether it was through the web page, through our April Fool's jokes, through customer service. And so I became the person who took responsibility for all of that. And I would write the language for things like the installer of the Google toolbar, which had some privacy implications. And one of the things that I was proud of, in terms of my contribution to the company, was coming up with language that let people know that there were privacy implications to the toolbar installation. And the wording I put on the software was, read this, it's not the usual yada yada. And I put that in big red letters so that nobody could miss it. And it described exactly what the trade-off was if you enabled the special features in the toolbar, which allowed Google to see web pages you were viewing online. And, you know, I think that kind of attitude and approach to privacy concerns early on gave Google a lot of latitude, because people really trusted that Google would notify them when they were doing something that might have privacy implications.
Well, and in those kind of gestures, there was this sort of human face being put on a company that still a lot of people didn't fully understand.
Well, exactly. It would have been very easy for people just to view Google as this tool, you know, a very impersonal technological tool that was just wires and machines and software. And the people behind the company, Larry and Sergey in particular, were so interesting and so had such strong personalities that it was important, I thought, to help translate that for users and to kind of channel their personality into the product. Now, and I talked about the fact that probably the single most important branding element at Google is the changing logo. And that was something that, much as I would love to take credit for, I actually opposed and fought against as hard as I could. Sergey was the one who said, no, I want to put cartoons on the logo. And I was like, you can't do that. You can't change your logo. I mean, branding is all about consistency, and you have to have the same look and feel every time a user comes to the site. He says, no, I like cartoons. I want to put them on the page, and people will think they're cute. And he turned out to be absolutely correct. So that was a case where I was overruled, and I was, you know, it was a good thing that I was, because if I hadn't been, Google would be a much more boring company than it is today.
You know, what you just talked about, I think, beautifully encapsulates this that you write in the chapter Fun and Names. You wrote, would Google never tire of succeeding with big ideas that I found patently ludicrous? It was starting to make me feel like a crotchety geezer yelling at kids to get off his lawn. So in other words, this was a pattern which occurred fairly often, that there would be these ideas, these proposals that struck you as outrageous and which you might have serious reservations about, that would ultimately prove to be tremendous successes. I mean, it had to be a really odd sensation to so often be that part of the equation at Google.
Well, exactly, and that's what I meant when I said, you know, you talked about a fish out of water. I constantly found myself questioning, well, you know, just because this is the way that I've done it in the past, does that mean it's the right way to do it here? And that was the process that Larry and Sergey wanted us to go through. They didn't want us to think that just because we had done something a certain way in a different job in an earlier part of our career, that that meant it was the right way to do it. And so every day that I came to work, I had to question, all right, now I'm making an assumption here. Is that the right assumption to make, or is there a different way to look at this? And that really kept the job from ever getting boring.
I bet. One thing that you had something to do with that was very valuable for Google was a process by which they were trying to design, I think, at the time, the Google Open Directory. And a choice had to be made about should all of these different features all be given very distinct names and terms. You have something to do with the very wise decision being made to keep everything under the umbrella term of Google. It's a relatively brief conversation, but you describe it as a quarter hour well spent. Tell us more about that.
And this is the kind of thing that, you know, in a normal company, and by normal I mean fairly traditional large corporation, you would spend weeks, if not months, debating a brand architecture. And the brand architecture determines, well, do you have a lot of little sub-brands? Do you have one major brand? Do you give everything a new name and try to launch it as an independent project and try to build audience for it separately from your primary brand? These are the things brand managers, you know, fixate on for long periods of time. And instead, I had a conversation with Salar Kamangar, who is now the head of YouTube at Google. And, you know, it just occurred to me that it would be better, instead of giving this Google Open Directory, our first new product, a separate name to indicate it was a completely distinct product from Google Search, we should just call it the Google Directory, and that we should name all of our products that way. We should call it Google Image Search or, you know, Google Calendar or Google Product Search, instead of trying to come up with new names for every product. And if we did that, it would enable the Google brand to become more powerful, because Google would then be associated with a whole range of things. And there would be no limit to what Google could get into, because you would just add the Google name and it would be, you know, become more powerful and more accepted. And this seems very common sense, you know, certainly in retrospect, what else would you have done? But in fact, we did make a couple of missteps, and I opposed them. One was Frugal, which was the product search product that we launched, that I really didn't want us to give it a name like Frugal. And we did, and ultimately they ended up changing it back to Google Product Search. So I felt some vindication in that one. But, you know, that kind of decision that has long-reaching implications, we never hesitated to make those very quickly and move on in the early days, because we just did not have the luxury of time to sit around and debate them.
On the other hand, there was, in your words, the excitement of working for a company unrestrained by precedent. We improvised as we went along and watched as the rest of the world caught up. Your book tells interesting stories about a big email debacle at Google, the very, very complicated story about Google and Yahoo. But because this is the 10th anniversary of 9/11, I wonder if you would just say a word about Chapter 16 of your book, in which you describe some of the really interesting, groundbreaking things that Google did in the wake of 9/11, 10 years ago.
Okay, Greg, after this one I'm going to have to cut out, because I do have another call coming in. After 9/11, Google, we were all, of course, tremendously affected by this, and we immediately began, and this was at Sergey's direction, Sergey Brin, he said, we need to find information we can put on the website, because all of the major news sites were experiencing congestion. That it was very hard to get to sites like CNN and the New York Times because the traffic was so heavy. And so he directed us to start taking pages that we could find online and then caching them, or taking essentially a photograph of them and then putting links to those cached versions on our page. And they also had us put up a directory of links to alternative news services and news services around the world that were covering this in the aftermath. But one thing that he also instructed us to try to do was to go through our log files, the records of all the searches we had conducted since the company started, and see if we could find information about anyone who might have used Google to help plan the attack. So he thought, because we didn't know at the time who had actually done this. It was still very early in the process. And so he wanted to try to help identify the terrorist. And he had us look through the log files to see if we could identify anyone who had searched for terms that might indicate they were planning the attack, things like, you know, explosive capacity of a fully loaded jetliner, or, you know, World Trade Center, and then, you know, how to land an aircraft, that kind of thing, or how to fly an aircraft. So the engineers actually did go through the log files. They did not find anything conclusive. They didn't find anything indicating a person had used Google to plan for the 9/11 attacks. But it was a very interesting exercise to me because it suggested that it would be possible, if you worked hard enough at it, to find an individual's web searches and construct their identity from the data that we had collected. And that was a real eye-opening moment for me. And, you know, a lot of people are concerned about privacy. And it's not that, you know, every search you do is linked to your name and address. It's not. It's much more anonymous than that. But most people do end up at some point searching for their own name. And so if all of your searches are linked together, the fact that one of those searches includes your name might indicate who you are and the other searches that you've done. So that was one of the things that I took away from that experience was, you know, we really need to be very careful about privacy. We need to be very communicative with our users about what kind of data we have and how we use it. Because Google doesn't abuse, or at least when I was there, you know, they did not abuse the information they had about what people search for, but the potential is there. I mean, if the government came in and said they needed to have all of the search records under subpoena, then, you know, there might be a problem concerning an individual's right to privacy.
Mm. That speaks to what you say is the company's biggest flaw, impatience with those not quick enough to grasp the obvious truth of Google's vision. That and much more in this fascinating book called I'm Feeling Lucky, The Confessions of Google Employee Number 59, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Douglas Edwards, thank you for writing this fascinating book and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it.
Thank you very much for letting me come on the program and spend some time with you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we look forward to the return visit of Dr. Art Sear, Clawson Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College, Director of the Clawson Center. He joins us once a month to offer his analysis of current events, and there's certainly no shortage of important items to be talking about for his visit tomorrow, including the deteriorating relationship between the Saudi Arabia and Iran, the North Koreans shooting off what they say was a hydrogen bomb, various serious tensions in Europe, and the current presidential race. That and much more will be talked about on tomorrow's Morning Show with Professor Sear. A reminder that you find The Morning Show archive on our website, WGTD.org. It's right on the front page. Support for The Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for The Morning Show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. It's a sunny but bitterly cold winter this morning in southeastern Wisconsin. Wind chills in some places down to 22 below zero. Skies will become cloudy. We'll have a bit of light snow this afternoon. We are headed for a high of 17 degrees. It will be very cold overnight, possibly an inch of light snow, a low tonight of 8 above. Tomorrow will be mostly cloudy with a high of just 11 above. And very cold on Wednesday as well under partly sunny skies, a high in the low to mid-teens and wind chills again easily down to 20 below zero. And then we see a warming trend up into the 30s by Thursday and Friday. This is WGTDHD, Kenosha.